and we will take up where we have left off. We've been focusing on the higher training and concentration, specifically how to generate serenity, and then the dhyanas, the form realm concentrations, and then the formless realm meditative absorptions. And then we talked about supernormal powers and other such things. Yeah, so today we are at the end of that section of talking about serenity from the viewpoint of the Sanskrit tradition. So there's two pages of instructions from His Holiness called Words of Advice. So that's, you know, from His Holiness about the Sanskrit tradition. And, you know, there's sometimes the feeling of, oh, words of advice, little bit at the end, it's a summary, we can go through it quickly, there's nothing much in it. Actually, here there's quite a bit in it that we will get to. And I have a very clear memory of when I was having the interviews with His Holiness, when he said this, which I'll describe a little bit afterwards. And then, so we do those two pages, then we'll start on chapter 9, which is developing concentration, how it's done in the Pali tradition. Yeah, and then after that, how it's done in the Chinese tradition. So in the description, the chapters about the Pali tradition and the Chinese tradition, we only talked about things that could be added to the explanation that we already had in the Sanskrit tradition. So it isn't like the complete description in the Pali tradition or in the Chinese tradition, but adding to what we talked about before that maybe didn't come in the Sanskrit tradition. Okay. But is useful and is quite interesting about, you know, to see how different commentaries brought out different points and emphasized them. Okay, so first of all, we'll start with the chanting and then some silent meditation, cultivate our motivation, and then go into the talk. Yeah. So all of us have high regard for the bodhicitta, that altruistic intention to attain full awakening in order to best be a benefit to all living beings. And what's our biggest obstacle to generating that motivation, that kind of mind? It's our old friend, the self-centered thought. And there's so many ways the self-centered thought comes up. It's very sneaky and very clever. And it'll even make us look on the outside like we're being very kind. But the motivation is entirely for our own benefit. So the two meditations here are quite important. One is the defects of following the self-centered thought, and the other is the benefits of cherishing other sentient beings. So we don't have so much time to go into these this evening. But take a minute and think about them briefly. Try and let your mind think about the long-term welfare of all beings and generate bodhicitta. So the self-centered thought is always kind of saying, I'm here, unless we don't want to be seen, in which case, I'm not here. Yeah. You know, like when you're called on to do something and you don't want to do it. Who are you talking to? Not me. Okay, so we, you know, our self-centered thought really holds us captive. Yeah, it runs the show, and it makes us do the things that make us not respect ourselves. You would think that the self-centered attitude would, at least if it's focused on us, it would try and do something good for us. But it so often does some things that really ruin things for us. Yeah. Because I think we all know, well, we all know when other people are very self-centered. Yeah. That they're quite disagreeable. It affects us. We don't like them. Yeah. But our self-centeredness is, you know, people should just really respect that I have my own ideas and I do what I want to do. Right? But other people shouldn't think like that because that's really self-centered. Yeah. Because when I want their attention, I should be able to snap my fingers and they pop up and say, yes, what can I do for you? But they don't do that. Yeah. So then when they want something from me, then I think, well, why should I do anything for them? Yeah. I'm just like you. We're all equal. I just feel like doing something else and doing my own thing. You know? So figure, you know, just too bad. You know what I mean? Yeah. Or we go out of our way, we help somebody, yeah. And then when they don't appreciate it enough, we go, oh, they're so selfish. I've worked so hard for you, and you don't appreciate it. You're so selfish. Right? And it's interesting how arrogance and self-centered thought can be very, very good friends. Yeah. Sometimes arrogance and low sometimes self-centered thought and low self-esteem are very good friends. You know, when we dig ourselves into a ditch and then just decorate it and stay there being miserable. Yeah. But with arrogance, it's like, I am me. Yes, I'm sitting up higher, looking up down at all you people. Yeah, because I'm better. Take that smirk off your face. And that phony smile. Because you don't know who you're talking to. So don't ask me to do anything because I'm too good to do anything for anybody else. They should be doing everything for me. So that I can do what I want to do. And I don't want to have to think about what the community needs, what anybody else needs. That's somebody else's idea, somebody else's responsibility. That's not my department. You know, we do everything according to departments, don't we? And Rhoda's. So, you know, it's not my name on the rota, and it's not my department. So I'm not going to lift even my little toe to help. I'm too good for that. Okay. Did you get the message? No. Now, that one. Almost hopeless. Except I don't give up. But she's getting there. Okay. So, we're on page 259. Yeah. And the section that's called Words of Advice. Okay, so His Holiness has been through the whole method for generating serenity and single-pointedness, and talked about the benefits, talked about the faults of not, you know, the interrupted, the hindrances, the antidotes, all that's covered, right? We got that down. Yeah, yeah. We all know it by heart. No need to go over it. No need to practice it because we're beyond that. Yeah. We're in single-pointedness. Yeah, when you're sleeping, you're single-pointed, aren't you? Yeah, no distraction. Okay, so here's... you know, during the series of interviews with His Holiness, yeah, covered a number of different topics. And so I had been asking some questions about serenity. And then his, and there were a couple of Geshe's there, two or three Geshe's, because His Holiness sometimes liked to discuss things with them in Tibetan and then, you know, give me the conclusion. So I asked some question. His Holiness answered it. And then he turned to the Geshe's and asked them a question. And they spent a long time talking about this in Tibetan. Yeah. And then this is what His Holiness said at the very end. Okay. So there are a number of Geshe's. They were from, most of them from the south. So the big monasteries. So he said, I would like to speak now to those who have completed many years of study in the monastic universities. So they've often been studying for, you know, 18, 20 years, sometimes more. It seems that some Tibetan Buddhists belittle serenity, perhaps because it is a practice shared with non-Buddhists, or perhaps because they are concerned with becoming attached to the bliss of concentration. So, you know, it could be either of these things. Some people may say, oh, well, serenity, it's, you know, common to Buddhists and non-Buddhists, so it's not so valuable, not so necessary. Or people could say, well, yes, and serenity is really useful and we need it, but... you know, knowing how attached I get, I'm, you know, I don't want to practice it now because I don't want to get hung up in just being blissed out and, you know, taking rebirth in one of the formless realms and not going any higher. Okay. So His Holiness continues, holding this attitude, they neglect trying to improve their concentration. So it could be either of those ideas. It could be other things too. Okay. They may be well-educated lamas who are able to teach topics from the beginning to the end of the path. Yet, because they lack single-pointed concentration, they cannot experience what they teach. So he's really talking to the lamas here, yeah? So the experience is described in Tsongkhapa's bright lamp of the five stages and completing the five stages in a single sitting are readily available for us to relish. Yet we haven't devoted the time and energy to attaining serenity, and these higher attainments evade us. So we may read, you know, these texts when they talk about the five stages. Here it's usually a tantric text talking about completion level practices, you know, and they know it back and forth and what you attain at what level and what you have to meditate on to get that, reach that level or have that experience, but they don't practice it themselves. Yeah. So I think we often do that, maybe not about highest class tantra, but we know the antidotes to anger, the antidotes to attachment. Yet when those afflictions arise in our mind, we don't apply. Yeah, we don't apply them. Oh, yes, the joy of being in a new building where everything works, including the buzzer that isn't supposed to go off. It works very well. Yes. Okay. So the lengthy texts on the Lamrim are designed to facilitate systematic practice of the topics explained in the classical treatises and commentaries, and as such, they should be our primary guide for Dharma practice. So the Lamrim is not some other teaching separate from studying all the classical texts. You know, the ornament for clear realization, the illumination of the path, you know, your Vinaya, the illumination of the path, Abhidharma text, all those things, Lakshin Nimbo. So you know all the information, but haven't really meditated on it, so it hasn't really sunk in the heart. And even if you've meditated on it and have a correct conceptual understanding, without the power of serenity, you can't really integrate it, yeah, with your mind. So His Holiness continues, but some people forget this and use the classical treatises to increase their intellectual understanding rather than incorporating them into the Lamrim practice. Other lamas may not read the Lamrim extensively and teach it simply because it is customary to do so. On the other hand, I have heard of some monks that meditate on the Lamrim while they study the treatises at the monastic universities. That is excellent. Okay. Because, you know, the program, the educational program that they have there, you receive teachings, then you go out on the debate ground and you start debating. Yeah, and you debate until like 11, 12 at night. And then, you know, you go to bed, get up in the morning, continue your memorization, go to class, and so on. Yeah. And so, you know, some of them just say, well, I don't have time with all my studies to do Lamrim. And some may just say, well, Lamrim is it's kids' stuff. It's the abbreviation of the classical texts. Yeah. And I know the classical text. Oh, it's an abbreviation of the classical text. I see. And you understand it all. Mm. Okay, please teach then the chapter on special insight from the Lamrim Chenmo. Anybody ever studied that chapter? Yeah. I studied it with a marvelous teacher, Geshe Zopa. Yeah. You know what I understood in that chapter? Vase. Yeah. I knew what a vase was. Everything else Tsongkhapa talked about in that chapter was above my pay grade, as they say. Yeah. Of course, this was a few years ago, so maybe my pay grade has gone up a little bit. Yeah, which means maybe I understand vase and flower now. Yeah, in case none of you don't know what I'm talking about, vase is often the example that they use when they're describing something. Either vase or sprouts. Okay. The definition of vase: flat bottom, rounded belly, no, bulbous belly water holder. Flat bottom, bulbous buried water holder. Okay. So what about this? Does this fit the definition? What isn't, you say no, why not? It's flat bottom. Yes, it is. It's not just one line, it goes up and it holds water. Yeah, their definition of bulbous doesn't mean it looks like that. Yeah. It just means it, yeah. A pot, the Tibetan word bumpa can be translated as pot, as cup, as glass, as vase. What else? Probably, you know, anything like that. So, anyway, at least I understood that word. Okay, but his point is here, you've got to understand more than bumpa. Yeah? So some people do retreats and recite many mantras. People go, yeah, yeah, that's me. I've recited 100,000 Vajrasattva. I've recited 100,000 Om Mani Padme Hum. Actually, more than that. I recited, 200,000 of Tara mantra. And I recite lots of mantra all the time. I'm very holy. Okay. So some people do retreats and recite many mantras. Although this is good, practitioners in retreat should meditate on the teachings they have received. Who has mentioned that before? Where it's gone in one ear and out the other. It's direct from His Holiness, yeah? Practitioners in retreat should meditate on the teachings they have received. Yeah, so that you're not just coming to class, hearing something, going away, forgetting it, but should really contemplate it. Yeah, try and understand. The autobiography of Jamyang Shepa, one of the great lineage lamas, relates that he did retreat on the 73 aspects of the three knowers as taught in the ornament of clear realization. Yeah. Now, when you study that 173, there's a lot of lists in it. There's a lot of definitions. There's a lot of words you don't know. And sometimes you go, why in the world are we studying this? But it's because it's laying out the path and different things that Shravakas realize on the path, solitary realizers realize, bodhisattvas practice. Okay. So Jamyang Shepa, that was Jeffrey's favorite one. Yeah, we've studied some of his texts. Yeah, so he did a retreat on the 173 aspects of the three knowers. Yeah. So he found a way to think about that in terms of his own life and make it something tasty so it wasn't just a bunch of lists. Yeah. Because he, you know, went deeper into it. So His Holiness says it would be good if more people did serious meditation on these and other topics taught in the Indian treatises and commentaries. So he's really encouraging that people not only do more analytic meditation on these topics, but also more develop serenity. Okay. Now, this doesn't mean that now, starting tomorrow morning, we all have to transform our problems, transform our practice and pull out a list of the 173 aspects of the three knowers. It doesn't mean that, but it does mean whatever we are learning, you know, especially hearing teachings on, we should think about. And when afflictions arise in our mind, you know, apply the antidotes to them. The disciplinarian of one monastic university suggested that periods of silent meditation be incorporated into the daily prayer sessions and pujas, and I enthusiastically agree. Now, you may be scratching your head and say, well, don't they already have periods of silent meditation? No. Yeah? And you see in the Chinese tradition, you know, when you go, people love chanting. So in a group, what do? You chant. Yeah. And so they may chant different texts, different sadhanas, you know, the names of the Buddhas, so many different things. But, you know, His Holiness has often said that we should really stop at certain points in the chanting and meditate. Yeah. He said, I enthusiastically agree to incorporate daily prayer sessions and pujas and, you know, incorporate meditative sessions in those. Pabongka Rinpoche used to remain in silent meditation on emptiness at the point of taking death as the path to the Dharmakaya when he did deity yoga practices. So some of you know what I'm talking about. Some of you probably have heard the teachings and don't remember. I have advised Namgyal Monastery to do this as well. Instead of chanting, everything becomes empty and within emptiness arises ... in the same breath. So the monasteries often do this, you know, Om Sobhavashudo Sarva Dharma Sobhavashudo Hom Tompa Nidu Gyor Tompe Nanle, and you're off and running. And he says, actually, we need to stop there and meditate on emptiness. Our monasteries must produce people who are accomplished meditators as well as still skilled scholars. So I think that's about the Abbey, too. You know, we're in our formative stage as practitioners and as a community, but what we would like to be to develop in time in terms of our own practice and in terms of what happens at the Abbey is, you know, to be able to produce accomplished meditators and skilled scholars. Yeah. To this end, I suggest that monastic institutions establish some colleges for meditation practice. So the large monasteries have different administrative departments. They're broken down into different colleges. Yeah. So you have, you know, you have Drepung Losaling and Drepung Gomang. Sarah J and Sarah May, like that. So His Holiness is saying, you know, there could be another college that really specializes in meditation, both analytical and serenity meditation. Yeah. So this is quite important here. Yeah. I also appeal to the new generations of monastics to put more effort into gaining personal experience of serenity and insight in order to preserve the realized Dharma and benefit sentient beings. Yeah, so when we study and learn, you know, the conceptual part of the path, you know, that enables us to sustain the transmitted Dharma, yeah, but the realized Dharma is what exists in people's mind that arises through their own practice of what they've learned in the transmitted Dharma. Okay, so we just finished chapter 8, now chapter 9, concentration in the Pali tradition. So within the Pali tradition, there are various approaches to the development of serenity and insight. According to the Majjhima Nikaya commentary, serenity includes the 8 meditative absorptions that are the basis for insight. Okay. Some teachers advocate cultivating serenity and insight separately and combining them afterwards. Of those, some emphasize developing serenity first, followed by insight, while others teach insight first, followed by samadhi. Still other meditation masters instruct their disciples to develop serenity and insight together. Teachers also have different preferences for meditation objects. Okay. So when I went to Thailand, to do research for, you know, these sections of the book, I had the idea, because I had Theravada friends and had talked with them, that, everybody did meditation on the breath and all teachers taught the same thing. So the same meditation technique. Yeah. Well, even in the Tibetan tradition, that doesn't happen. Different teachers have different things that they emphasize and different approaches to go into the topics. So similarly in the Pali tradition. Yeah. So there's not just one way of doing meditation. Initially, when I thought of doing like this section, I thought, I'll go to this one monastery, learn how this master describes it, and everybody else is pretty much the same. So I'll just talk about what he says. Yeah. And in discussing this with Bhikkhu Bodhi, he said that's not a very good idea because different teachers teach things differently. And like this paragraph says, some emphasize serenity first, then insight, some insight, and then serenity. Some develop at the same time. Some say when you're doing breathing meditation, place your attention at the upper lip and the nostrils. Other people say when you're doing it, place your attention on your abdomen. You know, there's so many different ways to do things. So he said it's much, Bhikkhu Bodhi said it's much better look at the scriptures and what the Buddha taught and describe that. So that's what I wound up doing, yeah. Of course, I think most of the meditation people and the teachers in the Theravada countries, they've studied the scriptures, yeah, so they know these things. But they, you know, there's also lineages of instructions passed down from one teacher to the next according to what, the teacher has found useful or illuminating in their own practice. Okay. it is important to train in samadhi under the guidance of a qualified teacher and not to do those practices on our own. But I'm a very intelligent person, and I really want to learn, and I want to do it quickly. I can't travel anywhere else. So, can't I just pick up one of these books and read it and follow the instructions? Well, you can do that. Maybe start and learn a little bit. But when you have questions, can you ask the questions to a book? No. So who are you going to ask the questions to? AI. Yeah, AI is, the heavenly Buddha who will know all answers. Yeah, I wonder what AI would say. Yeah. And do you think AI, who knows more, AI or your spiritual mentor? Well, AI has had all the scriptures fed into them. AI knows everything. Okay, so do your prostrations to AI, make offerings. Yeah, sit at the feet of AI. And who's your guru? Yeah. Well, that all the chatbots have names now. So your guru is, Geshe Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Yeah, and I learned samadhi from him. So be careful. I mean, this is what is, that we really need now our discriminating awareness more than before so that we don't just become slaves of AI and believe everything AI says. Yeah, that can be quite dangerous. Yeah, be interesting. AI, what can I do when I can't concentrate? Yeah, oh, you asked AI that question? Okay, what did AI said?
Well, I asked it, I'm stuck in my meditation practice. What should I do? And I promise this wasn't a real question. This was just to see right now what it would say.
Oh, yeah, I see. Right, right. Okay, yes. And what did AI say?
It actually gave a very, very long answer. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting in that it was saying, you could switch from meditating on the breath to meditating on sound or metta, loving kindness. So it's kind of taking a very general approach here. I didn't say it was Buddhist meditation. It didn't mention finding a teacher. It did mention turning to an app or YouTube.
Did it recommend which app to go to? No, it's okay. I just yes or no. You don't need to tell me.
It did mention some specific teachers to listen to, and I'm sorry, you're not listed. The other children is listed. I'm sorry.
The other children.
So yes, I'm a little disappointed because I was hoping it would tell me to just go talk to my teacher rather than give me advice.
But it didn't. So no. You need to tell AI, that they recommended you to somebody who wasn't already your teacher.
Okay. I'll have a long, detailed conversation with it.
Yes, yes. And that, if your previous teacher was Mickey Mouse, they should have recommended you go to Mickey Mouse and ask your questions.
Okay.
No. Yeah. And AI will say, yes, M-I-C-E-K-E-Y. Okay. Oh, you're typing that. Good. You'll remember it. Okay. Okay, so the first section here is objects of meditation. So we'll go through this. You may want to look back at when we talked about, in the Sanskrit tradition, objects of meditation.
By the way, you didn't, there's still below the last paragraph before. I think you only got to
what?
The last paragraph, you didn't finish.
I didn't finish.
We got off on
that. Oh, yes, I did. Okay. So it is important to train in samadhi under the guidance of a qualified teacher and not to do these practices on our own. Working with the mind is a delicate venture, and without proper guidance, it is easy to go astray. A good meditation master who understands the various experiences that may arise in meditation will be able to steer you in the correct direction and confirm your progress. This enables you to practice free from worry and prevents taking unnecessary detours on the path. Okay, so objects of meditation. Depending on the disciple's temperament, a meditation teacher usually describes one of 40 objects for the cultivation of serenity. Okay, there are six kinds of temperaments. So they are those people who are the temperament of being angry, confused, faithful, intelligent, speculative, and scattered. Which one are you? All of them. Scattered. Okay. How many are angry? Angry disposition. Okay. Confused. Faithful. Intelligent. Speculative. And scattered. Oh, scattered one. What? Oh, we forgot attached. Well, it's not listed in here. Oh, it's the first one. Yes, attached. Oh, we have that problem too. Imagine that. Yeah. These temperaments depend on a person's habits and the balance of humors in their body. Okay, so probably having to do with the airs, the lung in your body, and then, of course, habits. Yeah. But what are habits? We think of habit as, oh, I have a bad habit. Yeah, it is cast in concrete. Yeah, it's so hard to change. My bad habits are concretized. What is a habit?
Repetitive action.
So it's one action that just repeats itself. Yeah? What?
Attachment to a pleasant distraction.
Attachment to a pleasant distraction. Okay, that's a habit. Yeah, yeah. It's one kind of habit. Yeah? Okay. When you really think about what is a habit, it's either a certain action or a certain motivation, a certain intention, whereby not the same thing comes up a lot, but there's something similar that comes up a lot. In other words, what is a habit? You can't say it's one thing because it's a series of events that are not the same but have some similarity. So if you think like that, what you're doing is deconstructing your habit and being able to see how it's empty of inherent existence. When you think of your bad habits being empty and being simply, you know, some mental factor that similar instances, not the same instances, but similar instances of it arise in different situations. That feels totally different than thinking of your habit as cast in concrete and therefore difficult to change. Doesn't it? Yeah. So try that sometimes instead of saying, oh, I'm just like this. As if, you know, there's one personality trait that never changes and it is always there. No, because the mind is changing moment by moment. It's not the same moment of mind from one moment to the next. It's not the same mental factor. Or it could be a similar mental factor or a different gradation of a mental factor. Okay. So there's these six kinds of temperament. The temperaments depend on habits and on humors in the body. A teacher discerns disciples' temperament by observing their posture, the way they walk, eat, wear their clothes, and engage in daily actions. Actually, when you observe those things about people, you can learn a lot about them, you know, about certain attitudes they have, certain behaviors, certain things like that. And you pick up a lot about of information that people tell you with their body language. Yeah. Okay, so there are 40 possible meditation objects. This is from the Visuddhimagga. So the first group is called the 10 kasinas. So the kasinas are these round, it could be square, patches of either a color or a substance that can be your meditation object. Okay? So the 10 kasinas are earth, water, fire, air, so the four elements, yellow, red, white, light, and limited space kasinas. So any of those can be your object of meditation. Okay, then the second group is called the 10 unattractive objects. Yeah, are corpses in various states of decay. Yeah, so unlike meditation on corpses in mindfulness of the body, where the purpose is to understand our own impermanence, here the purpose is to focus single-pointedly on the object with no reflective thought. Okay, so you might visualize, you know, a corpse in very, you know, that's in the middle of decaying at very, you know, one stage of the or the other of corpses. So when you do this practice, you can do it as of thinking corpses. It can be an antidote to attachment, because when you think about corpses, your attachment goes down, especially if it's sexual attachment. It comes in the four establishments of mindfulness, establishment of the body. One of them is to meditate on a corpse, to really understand what a corpse is, you know, and to also, you know, get some idea that this thing is a walking corpse. Yeah, it's nothing more than that. It's nothing special. Yeah, it is a walking corpse. Yeah, this is also very good for arrogance. Yeah. Okay. So, and then the third group for meditation objects are the 10 recollections. So these are recollections on mindfulness of the Buddha, mindfulness of the Dharma, mindfulness of the Sangha, mindfulness of ethical conduct, mindfulness of generosity, mindfulness of deities, in other words, the divine qualities of the devas, often in the form and formless realms, death, the body, breathing, and nirvana. Okay, so when you do recollections of any of these, you start by thinking about the object so that you get some clarity on what it is and how it functions and so on, and then you place your attention on it. Yeah. So let's say mindfulness of the Buddha, you would go through the different qualities of the Buddha. So that would bring you back to chapters 1 and 2 in this book. Yeah. And then you place your mind, you know, on the qualities of the Buddha. Or, like we do in Tibetan practice, maybe on the Buddha's body. Yeah, you've learned the qualities of the Buddha's body. Okay, then the next group is the 4 divine abidings, the 4 immeasurables: love, compassion, empathetic joy, and equanimity. Our 4 kitties. Okay, next group is the 4 formless states. So they are the bases of infinite space, infinite consciousness, nothingness, and neither discrimination nor non-discrimination, which in the Sanskrit tradition is called the peak of samsara. So these are the meditation objects to those born in the formless realms. Yeah, that's what they meditate on. Okay, another possible object is 1 discrimination, which is discerning the repulsiveness of food. We usually meditate on the good qualities of food and imagine, you know, all these different dishes we can make and, you know, mix. What are we going to mix today? We're going to have beets, yeah, with orange juice mixed with sesame seeds and ketchup. Yeah. Okay. So, no, here it's discerning the repulsiveness of food, which I just described. Okay. And another object is called 1 analysis, which is defining the 4 elements. Yeah, earth, water, fire, and air. So of these 40 potential objects, 22 have a counterpart sign as an object. Okay, we're getting the counterpart sign is like a small thing that appears after you've meditated on the object for a while. We'll get into that a little bit later. Or here, I can read you in the glossary. Okay. A counterpart sign. The meditation object of a dhyana consciousness, a conceptual object that arises on the basis of a visible object. Okay. So 22 of those have the counterpart sign as the object. I mean, as the object means the actual object that you generate serenity with. So those 22 are the 10 kasinas, the 10 unattractive objects, yeah, which must be the corpses, the decaying corpses, when it's blue, when it's black, when it's red, when it's mushy, you know. Okay, mindfulness of breathing and mindfulness of the body. This means the actual object, when serenity is attained, is the counterpart sign, a clear, luminous mental image or conceptual appearance, which is an object only of mental consciousness. Okay. So although we may begin by focusing on the breath, for example, the breath is not the actual object perceived in states of deep concentration. The sign, yeah, or nimitta is. Okay. So you start out with the breath. It's a gross object. You know, it helps you to concentrate on the body, you know, when it's a physical sensation. It is some, for some people, it can be easier to come and concentrate on that. But it's not that you get into single-pointed concentration and the object is your breath. Inhale, exhale, inhale, exhale. No, it's not that. Of these 40 objects, the 8 recollections, eight of the 10 recollections, so omitting mindfulness of the body and mindfulness of the breathing. Okay, so the 8 recollections, the discrimination of the repulsiveness of food, and the defining of the 4 elements bring excess concentration. So excess concentration is serenity, yeah, and you access concentration comes before entering, especially the first dhyana. If you remember that each dhyana has preparation stages that you do, so the one for the first dhyana is usually called. And when you attain that, that's usually called access concentration. Okay. All the other objects will bring full absorption, which means into a dhyana. Yeah. Any of the kasinas is a condition for cultivating the first 5 superknowledges. That's interesting. A beginner initially apprehends the various objects in different ways. All the kasinas except the arakasina are initially apprehended by sight. Yeah. So, for example, the earth kasina is a round disc made of clean clay about 4 fingers wide. It is put on a piece of wood, and it is braced up and placed on a board in front of the meditator. So you look at it with your eyes, and then you close your eyes and recreate a conceptual appearance of it. Okay? So that's how you're meditating on that. But it's interesting because they really have you start out a lot with looking at objects and then going from that into something that's just with your mental consciousness. Yeah. So, you know, years ago, the great fad, was meditating on candle flames. Yeah. Any of you do that? Yeah. You sit down and you look at a candle flame. And, you know, because you have no idea what concentration is, and because AI didn't exist then, you were totally lost and you thought you understood what it was about. Yeah. And you think, okay, I just stare at this candle. Don't blink. And you think, that's how I'll develop concentration. You get a headache usually by the end of that. Yeah, that's not the way to develop concentration. But it's like in the Tibetan tradition, when we meditate, we develop serenity based on an image of the Buddha. We look at the image of the Buddha, then we close our eyes and we imagine it. So it's the same kind of idea. Yeah. Okay. So a beginner initially apprehends the various objects in different ways. All kasinas except the arakasina are initially apprehended by sight. Yeah. Erica Sina, can you see air with your eyes? You can see the things floating in the air, but that's not the air. Yeah. So air probably would be a tactile sensation, yeah. For example, the Earth Cassina is a round disc made of clean clay about 4 fingers wide. It is braced up and placed on a board in front of the meditator. The 10 unattractive objects are also first seen by the eyes. In previous times, meditators went to charnel grounds to view these, because when somebody died, they would just throw the body in a charnel ground. Yeah, unless you were the spouse of an emperor, in which case they'll build the Taj Mahal for you. Yeah. Everybody else went to the charnel grounds. Yeah, where the animals came and the animals would gnaw on the bones and eat the flesh. So the body's innards are known by hearing descriptions of them or going to an autopsy, which, you know, the Theravada monks do. The breath is apprehended by the tactile consciousness. You feel the sensation on the upper lip or in the nose. The Erika-sena is apprehended by sight and touch. So touch, you feel the air. Sight, probably because you see things flying in it, so you have a conceptual idea of what must be making that happen. Okay, and the remaining objects by hearing a description of them. Beginners cannot apprehend the divine abiding of equanimity or the 4 formless states. Only experienced meditators are able to engage with those objects. Okay, so the 40 objects can be correlated with various temperaments. If we are aware of our overall temperament, we can get a sense of the type of object that it would be most beneficial for us to focus on. If we have a lot of attachment, using the 10 ugly objects, okay, the corpse at various stages of decay, and the body, thinking about the insides of the body, and the outside, too. The outside can be pretty ugly and gross and smelly as well. Okay. If we have a lot of attachment using the 10 ugly objects, and the body is helpful to reduce attachment and focus the mind. If we suffer from anger, the 4 divine abidings and the 4 color casinas are useful. Well, clearly we understand why the four immeasurables would be good if you have a problem with anger. And they really help, you know, they help so much. As well as the long rim meditation on the kindness of sentient beings. Yeah. Okay, those who are confused or scattered find the breath a helpful meditation object because it's something that is easy to find and settles your mind and in your body. Someone inclined towards faith will find the first 6 recollections riveting. Yes, they would want to, you know, meditate on the qualities of the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, generosity, ethical conduct, yeah, these things. And you can see when you, meditate on those objects, it really changes your mind and it increases your faith because you see the good qualities of those things. Someone inclined towards faith, yeah, will find the first 6 recollections riveting. Okay, then the recollection of death, nirvana, and the meditation defining the 4 elements and the repulsiveness of food are useful for the intelligent. Okay, and then the other kasinas and the four formless states can be used by all. Yeah, even though it said that four formless ones, only experienced meditators are able to engage with them. So you wouldn't use that as your beginning practice. Before going to a quiet place to practice, we should fully dedicate ourselves to the Buddha. Yeah, thinking, I give my life to the Buddha. Do we do that? Yeah. Do we dedicate our life to the Buddha and say, you know, I give my life to the Buddha. This is what is most important. This is what's most meaningful. This is, yeah, what I want to do. So doing this strengthens the mind. So if we encounter something frightening, we will not run into town or down the hill, socialize with a lot of people, or give up our practice. Okay, so saying here that we, you know, when you do serenity practice or any meditation practice for that matter, yeah, sometimes you have different experiences that you haven't had before and you don't know what to do with them, okay? So some people get frightened, they have a strange experience in their body, or they're have a good imagination, and they see something, or who knows what. Yeah, there's all sorts of things. And so sometimes people get scared and run down the hill or, you know, go and get some ice cream and chocolate and, you know, cover up your misery and your pain by distraction. Okay. Rushing off to an isolated place with a lot of enthusiasm, but no knowledge on how to meditate, will not lead to fulfillment of our spiritual aims. Okay, so all of us who are gonna, you know, go find that nice heated aircon cave and just sit down and cross our legs and get enlightened. Yeah, when you have no knowledge of how to meditate, then you basically invent your own meditations. Yeah, and this is something that concerns me with the number of people who are relying on apps for meditation. Yeah, because some apps, basically, they shouldn't be called meditation. They should be called relaxation. Okay, guided relaxation. Because they tell you put on your favorite music, that's soothing, lie down on something soft and comfortable, close your eyes, dream of something beautiful, something you've always wanted, and let your mind relax. And that's, you know, you've paid your $99.95 to get your app tape with that instruction, and you assiduously follow it, thinking that you're meditating. But that's not real meditation. It's helpful for people, you know, it can help them relax, but it's not what in Buddhism is called meditation. I had an interesting experience along that line one time because in 1990 there was a Jewish delegation that went to Dharamsala, and I went there, and, you know, I didn't get to go in the sessions they had with His Holiness, but in the other sessions I talked to some of them and, you know, learned about what they do and so on. Hold on a second. I was going to tell you a story about that. Now I can't remember which story I was going to tell. Yeah. It'll come. Oh, now I remember. Okay. So the one of the rabbis, Rabbi Salman, he was a very well-known rabbi because he did a lot of New Age kind of things. And his wife did it as well. So I went to visit them one time. And she said she does guided meditations. So she said, would you like me to guide you in a meditation? So, you know, okay, let's see what kind of things they do. Yeah, so I forget if I lay down or sat up or whatever. Oh, no, I think I was laying down. And then she would ask me a question. She would say, like, okay, imagine you're on the beach, you know, and it's beautiful and sunny and the right temperature. And so, you know, you imagine that. And then, you know, everything around you is nice and your belly is full, but not too full. You know, she sets this whole stage. And then, you know, and then the water, since you're lying on the beach, the water is, coming up. And so the water, is going to, this is going to purify you, yeah. So, I was a California girl. I thought of my days on the West Coast beach. Okay, and so then she's saying, okay, so the water comes, and it comes in your feet, and then it leaves very gently. And then it comes again, it comes up to your knees, and it purifies, you know, any kind of karma or any discomfort, and then it gently flows out. And so she was starting to do this, you know, starting with the soles of my feet working up. Okay, so after about three things like this, I said, wait, this is not working for me. Yeah. And I said, I was imagining salt water from the Pacific. When I'm on the beach, that's what comes. Well, salt water from the Pacific, I don't see as something clean and purifying. Yeah. It's not. And I say, and I told her, in Buddhism, what I am visualized, I'm used to visualizing like the Buddha on top of my head and light and nectar coming from the Buddha and coming down into me and purifying. And so I said, I told her, first of all, the ocean water doesn't work. And also, being purified, starting with the bottom of your feet, that just was weird. I said, I'm so used to the Buddha on the top of your head and the light and nectar coming down. And the light and nectar is very pure. Yeah. And there's no seaweed in it. It doesn't taste like stinky ocean salt water. Yeah. There's no waves crashing on your head. I mean, I love the beach when, you go to the beach. But when that was not, for me, the object of meditation. So my point in telling you that story is that people have different things that they call meditation that from a Buddhist viewpoint, we wouldn't call meditation. We would call it, relaxation or creative guidance or something, Okay. So I'm going to read this paragraph again because it's important. Before going to a quiet place to practice, we should fully dedicate ourselves to the Buddha, thinking, I give my life to the Buddha. Doing this strengthens the mind, so if we encounter something frightening, we will not run into town, socialize with a lot of people, or give up our practice, which is what people often do if they have an unusual experience or if the attainments don't come quick enough and they want quick attainments. Okay. Instead, even if a fearful image appears, we won't be alarmed because we have dedicated ourselves to the Buddha. In other words, you take refuge. So there's nothing to be frightened of. A good motivation, one that seeks to gain realizations on the path to arhatship, is also important, as is a strong determination to confront and work with the afflictions. Okay, so I have a strong motivation to gain realizations, but the mind cannot be tight. Yeah, we think a strong motivation is, I'll get a single-pointedly. You know, no, you're not with that kind of mental state. Okay, yeah, you're going to get ulcers and a headache. You won't get serenity. Yeah, so, okay, we need a good motivation, seeking realizations on the path, and a strong determination to confront and work with the afflictions. Yeah, the anger, the attachment, the arrogance, all these things. Okay. Rushing off to an isolated place with a lot of enthusiasm, but no knowledge on how to meditate will not lead to fulfillment of our spiritual aims. At the beginning of a meditation session, review the disadvantages of sensual desire and cultivate the wish to be free from it. Yeah, we should do this actually as a daily practice. Every day, think about the defects of sensual desire and cultivate the wish to be free of it. Yeah, because we are addicted to sensual desire. Nice sights and sounds, smells, tastes, touches. Yeah. Okay. Recollect the qualities of the three jewels and feel joyful. So that's how we should start a meditation session. Not, oh God, I got to sit down and meditate. I want to go back to sleep. Yeah. Or, oh, I'm going to sit down and meditate. I had this far out meditation yesterday. Let's see if I can do it again. Yeah, I was seeing these swirls of colors coming in and making different forms that kind of look like Buddhas and then vanished into the sky. It was so far out, you know, better than whatever the latest drug is. Yeah. No, that's just distraction. Attachment to sensual desire, too. Okay. So recollect the qualities of the three jewels and feel joyful. Reflect that you are entering the path of renunciation that all Aryas have followed. Feel eager to meditate, knowing that by doing so, you will gain the bliss of Dharma realizations. So rejoice that you're entering the path of renunciation. What are you renouncing?
Suffering.
Dukkha. Samsara. Okay. We want to be free of that. And it's the path that all the Aryas have followed. You know, they all generate that mental state. So, you know, this is how to start our practice. Take refuge. Have a good motivation. You want to attain realizations for the benefit of sentient beings. Yeah. You want to develop renunciation of samsara so you don't get all distracted and hung up by all sorts of different, yeah, stupidagios. Okay, so we're going to stop here this evening. Next paragraph gets into the nimitta, so we will do that in January. Okay, so the next weeks I did a list of topics, you know, to cover in the sessions. And so everybody will have a topic, and you give a synopsis of that topic, starting, they're all topics from this volume. And then think of three questions that go along with the synopsis that you've given, with the chapter, for people to think about and then discuss afterwards, you know, like during the week. Okay. What?
Aren't we going to be in silent retreat?
Yes, but Friday night, you know, instead of just stopping the class, there's going to be class. Okay. Yeah. You know, there's people online who want to watch, but having class will help you in your retreat, because you're going to be reviewing all the things that you should be meditating on. Okay. Okay, so any questions or comments? Yeah.
Of the objects, I was a bit confused about the recollection of ethical conduct and generosity in this context, that certainly there's the analytical meditation about ethical conduct and generosity. Okay,
yeah.
That makes sense to me, but I don't know what it would look like to then use that as the object of a meditation.
Yeah.
You
would do the analytic meditation on that, and then from that you get, you know, it's not a visual picture you get, but what you get is a feeling of, I want to be generous. And generosity is really, you know, generosity creates so much good and happiness in this world. Yeah, so that kind of thing would come up and you would focus on it. That's my understanding anyway. Mm-hmm.
Venerable, which traditions use the kasinas? Is it just the Theravada?
Yeah, the Theravada. I don't think the Chinese use it. I haven't heard it in that context. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. On page 259, you read earlier about these lamas who are able to teach topics from the beginning to the end of the path, yet because they lack single-pointed concentration, they can't experience what they teach. But you spent a long time earlier, too, talking about the fact that we have to have all of these conditions in our life to practice concentration.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe there's just some lifetimes where that's just not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be the case for these people, too, right? There's just been no space in their
yeah.
Geshe training and all of that.
Yeah. But His Holiness is saying, he's saying to those lamas, you should find sometime you understand those objects, put some time into serenity as well. Yeah, he's not saying stop everything else you're doing and go into retreat. Yeah. Anything else? Tracy?
Is it common or possible for someone's temperament to make a big change in their lifetime? Or?
A big change
in a disciple's temperament?
Oh, in a disciple's temperament. There could be. Yeah.
I guess there was also a line on page 263. We should request our spiritual mentor to select a meditation object for us. Is that something a person does right away, or do they wait till they practice a while?
I think sometimes at the beginning people can just meditate on what is feels comfortable to them of these, or you get specific instructions how your teacher starts everybody off. You know, like in Thailand, they usually start you off with some type of meditation on the breath. But then some teachers start you off, you know, doing it this way or that way. Or, yeah. So it isn't like at the very beginning everything has to be personalized for you, because it's not like when you're a beginner you're going to sit down and, you know, get realizations after 3 minutes or something. Okay, so we will stop here. So in these teachings, when they're talking about, you know, really being serious about gaining serenity, you know, you have to see, am I at that place in my practice? Do I have those conditions to do that? Yeah. And does that mean that if you don't, that you don't do anything to try and improve your concentration? No, it doesn't mean that. You know, there's lots of instructions, and you do a little bit and try and improve your concentration. But, the way I like to recommend people, I think what you should really focus on at the beginning is the mind training teachings, that help you figure out and learn how to deal with different situations and different emotions that arise. Because this is what really knocks people around is, you know, some powerful emotion comes up and then you just fall apart. Yeah, or you get totally distracted or who knows what. Yeah. So I think, you know, that is something to really, that and ethical conduct. And the two go together. Because if you practice ethical conduct, you're going to be taming some of those crazy emotions too, and having to apply the antidotes. Yeah, so those thought training and ethical conduct are good marriage. Okay, let's dedicate.